This is the Music History In-Depth podcast for March 5th through the 11th. On this week's show, a bromance changes music forever, two artists pass away long before their time, and we discuss how a future music legend broke major world news. This show goes more in depth about some of the events that we put on our daily podcast, the Music History Today podcast, which drops every single day, including weekends, wherever you get your podcast from. Now, on to this week's episode. In 1994, a bromance was formed over the internet that would eventually transform the music industry, both for the good and for the bad, actually. It was in that year that teenagers Sean Fanning and Sean Parker met in an online chat group. They became friends over hacking, programming, theoretical physics, you know, the typical kid stuff. As they got older, they got an idea about file sharing over the internet, specifically about sharing MP3 files. On June 1st, 1999, they released their file sharing program known as Napster. Within a year, the Windows-based program amassed millions of people who were sharing song files for free. Mac users got an official version in 2000 after a couple of unofficial versions were released by other people. The implications of this program are now obvious, although, as with most things historical, no one really knew it at the time. Before Napster, if you wanted to get a specific song, you only really had three ways of getting it. The first was to pray that the record company released the song as a single, or at least the B-side to another single. The second was to wait patiently by the radio with your two fingers on the cassette buttons, praying that the radio station would at least play a song and that the radio station disc jockey wouldn't speak over the song. Always a fun one. The third was you could just buy the entire album, CD, cassette, whatever the song was on. Napster also hit at the absolute perfect time because of an overlooked fact by people who like to talk about that era. The fact of the matter was that record companies were getting extremely greedy with their pricing. Okay, actually greedier than they normal are, but you know. They jacked up the prices so much that it was tough to justify paying for one or two songs off of an album, especially if the album just flat out sucked. Michael Bolton's album, Time, Love, and Tenderness, was the first to test the greed factor, clocking in at an astounding $18.98 list price just for one CD. Vinyl by then had died a pretty miserable death, only to be hipster zombified in the past decade or so. Seriously, people, $30 list price for an LP record now? Y'all are stupid for paying that kind of money. But I digress. This is not about the LPs. When faced with a $19 plus tax list price for one or two songs that you liked off of an album, or, better yet, getting those songs that someone burned from their CD copy for free off of the internet, you can pretty much figure out which choice most people under the age of 40 went with. Of course, with any popular new technology, you're going to have competition, and you're also going to have enemies, and Napster certainly found plenty of both. Soon, copycat sites started popping up like LimeWire, Kazaa, Score, Freenet, etc., etc. And then, hackers and others would put songs with viruses encoded into them, spreading malware and such to scare people from using the free programs. And then, the music industry came calling. The first artists were Metallica, who saw that their song I Disappear had leaked onto Napster. Then they saw that their entire catalog was being shared online for free. They sued Napster to get every copy of every song of theirs taken down. And then Dr. Dre came along and did the same thing with his music. The problem for the recording industry was profound. For starters, Albums would routinely sell at least 1 million copies. After Napster, they stopped. I mean, why would they if you're putting out an inferior product, mind you? Second, MP3s officially didn't exist in their eyes. They didn't release them. They had no stores to sell them, and I highly doubt that if you asked a record exec at the time what an MP3 was, they wouldn't have known the answer other than to say that it was hurting their business. iTunes didn't even exist yet. In fact, if it wasn't for Steve Jobs putting all of the record label heads into a room and having his now famous ultimatum of, quote, here's what iTunes is and here's what you're going to do or you'll die, end quote, meeting, the music industry as we know it would have died a very painful self-inflicted death a long time ago, at least 25 years by now. I say self-inflicted because of the history of the industry, which is that whenever anything new comes along, they basically do the following. First, they stick their heads in the sand and pretend that it's not hurting them. Then, they demonize the new technology and sue whoever put it out or has it, making enemies of the electronics industry along with their very own fans. They did this when the cassette was invented, going after manufacturers of cassette machines, and they did it here. Boy, did they do it here. First, A&M Records filed suit against Napster on the grounds of copyright infringement. The Recording Industry Association of America, the trade group that covers the record labels, ran shotgun on that particular lawsuit. And then, the Recording Industry Association of America went after actual consumers. They started suing individual people for thousands of dollars who downloaded anything off of Napster and other programs. They sued colleges that had computer servers on their campuses that were being used to download from Napster for their students. The entire thing was a complete PR nightmare for the industry, although the RIAA, Metallica, Dr. Dre, and others did actually, honestly, have a point. They can't make money if they're giving away their music for free. Point, end point. That's it. The court system also saw it the same way. Napster lost the court case, and on March 6th, 2001, Napster started complying with the court order by taking down and blocking songs from being shared, effectively killing their company, at least in the short term. I say short term because Napster as a company isn't actually dead, much like MySpace isn't officially dead. Napster filed for bankruptcy, where its brand and assets were bought and changed hands through a number of companies, from Best Buy to streaming service Rhapsody. Actually, when you think about its match with a streaming service, it kind of makes sense, since Napster was sort of a streaming service, although no one was really getting royalties off of the songs. As far as Sean Fanning and Sean Parker go, don't really cry for them. They're fine. Fanning has gone on to create many other companies, including Rupture, Path, Snowcap, and Airtime. Parker became a technology investor, starting with a little company at the time that you might have heard of, although at the time it was called The Facebook. Parker was actually their first president, and he was the one who got Mark Zuckerberg complete control over Facebook so that he couldn't be kicked out of his own company like Steve Jobs was during his first time at Apple. Parker, by the way, is now worth at last check over $2.2 billion. As far as the recording industry goes, they, of course, finally got on board with MP3s thanks to Steve Jobs, iTunes, and the iPod. It's opened up the playing field for artists like Chance the Rapper to have careers without a major record label deal. Plus, while Napster killed the album and created a singles culture for musicians, it actually opened up new technology like streaming services like Spotify to exist, though I'm not a fan of renting my music because an artist will get into a fight with one of those streaming services and pull their music off of it. Looking at you, UMG and TikTok. Then, what do you do at that point? Oh, and streaming services and putting music videos on YouTube and other places were also things that the music industry first went after until they learned to embrace the technology. And by embrace, I mean make a whole lot of money off of it. Watch, they'll complain about AI too. Actually, they've already started. Until they figure out a way to use AI vocals without having to pay someone royalties or maybe create complete AI avatars with AI vocals and then have them do hologram tours. Trust me, that's coming. God bless the dinosaurs that are the record labels. God bless their little greedy hearts. The beginning of the end of Napster, as everyone knew it, began when they lost their court case on March 6th, 2001. Before we go any further, we'd like to tell you about our other podcasts. The Music History Today podcast goes over the daily events in music history and drops daily, including weekends, on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. There's also the Music Halls of Fame podcast, which talks about a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, along with other Music Halls of Fame's museums and walks of fame. The Music Halls of Fame podcast drops every Thursday and can also be found on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to this podcast. Now, on to two artists whose lives were cut short way before their time. First, no one knew it at the time, but a young woman who was on TV the night of January 21st, 1957, would go on to become a country music icon, and it took a reality TV show to show her to the national public. Back in the 1940s and 50s, Arthur Godfrey was the Dick Clark, or in this era, Ryan Seacrest of television. He had a bunch of shows, both on radio and TV, and was a household name. One of his shows was called Arthur Godfrey's Talent Scouts, where amateur entertainers would get their big breaks. It was a contest show. People would go on, do their performances, and the audience would pick the winner. Think of it as maybe American Idol before there was such a thing, or for the oldies in the group, Star Search. Go with that. In order to be on this show, you had to audition. Some people who were deemed not worthy to be on the show included Buddy Holly and Elvis Presley. Go figure. That does not, however, detract from the show's track record. Their list of soon-to-be stars who got their start on the show are Tony Bennett, Pat Boone, Lenny Bruce, the comedian, and Marilyn Horne. On January 21st, 1957, a young woman from Winchester, Virginia, went on the show and performed the song Walking After Midnight. She won the contest that night. And that was when the world first heard of Patsy Cline. Patsy was born Virginia Patterson Hensley on September 8, 1932, in Winchester, Virginia. She started out singing locally in Virginia at the age of 15. She married her first husband, Gerald Cline, in 1953 and was signed to the Four Star record label in 1954. Over the next couple of years, Patsy had a couple of small hits, 1955's A Church, A Courtroom, Then Goodbye, and 1956's I've Loved and Lost Again, but not much more than that. In 1957, she performed nationally on Arthur Godfrey's Talent Scouts, and after that, her life completely changed. First off, in 1957, Patsy divorced Gerald Cline, but kept his last name for working purposes. She then got married to Charles Dick later in the year, and in 1958, she had a child. She moved to Nashville in 1958 to further her career. She found new management, became a member of the Grand Ole Opry, and signed to Decca Records. Patsy got into a serious car accident in 1961, which took her about 6 months or so to recover completely from. Patsy would go on to have many hits from 1960 to 1963, including this particular classic, which was the song Crazy, And that was written by soon-to-be country music legend himself, Willie Nelson. When Patsy Cline's husband first brought the song to her attention, he reportedly said, quote, "The song's crazy." To which Patsy reportedly said, quote, "It certainly is." Guess she wasn't a big fan of the original version. To be fair, Willie's demo track had him speaking the words rather than singing them. Patsy gave it a chance, though, recorded the song on August 21st, 1961, and released it on October 16th, 1961. The song became a big hit, going to number 2 on the Billboard Country chart and top 10 on the Pop Singles chart. Aside from Crazy, Patsy had hits like the aforementioned Walking After Midnight, I Fall to Pieces, When I Get Through With You, Leaving On Your Mind, So Wrong, and She's Got You. In early 1963, Kansas City, Kansas DJ Cactus Jack Call was killed in a car accident. On March 3, 1963, 3 benefit concerts were held for his family in Kansas City, Kansas. The concerts were stacked with soon-to-be country music legends. George Jones performed, as did Billy Walker, Dottie West, Cowboy Copas, along with Hawkshaw Hawkins of the group Ozark Jubilee. Patsy, who was sick that day, still performed all 3 shows. Then she went to the Townhouse Motor Hotel to rest up for the night for a flight out of Fairfax Airport back to Nashville, Tennessee, the very next day. Unfortunately, March 4th was a foggy day in the area and the airport was fogged in. Dottie West, who was making the 8-hour drive back to Nashville with her husband, asked Patty if she wanted a ride. Now, here is where history eerily repeated itself. Flashback to the night of February 3rd, 1959 at the Surf Ballroom in Clear Lake, Iowa. J.P., the big bopper Richardson, asked a young Waylon Jennings if he could take Jennings' seat on a Beechcraft 35 Bonanza airplane instead of the freezing bus that their tour was supposed to take to their next stop in Fargo, North Dakota. Jennings said yes. When fellow tour mate Buddy Holly found out about this, he good-naturedly kidded with Jennings, saying, quote, "I hope your old bus freezes up." To which Jennings kidded, quote, "Well, I hope your old plane crashes." That phrase haunted Jennings for the rest of his life, as the plane that had the big bopper, Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, and their pilot crashed only a few hours after that remark, killing all on board. That crash became immortalized in Don McLean's classic song, American Pie, as the day the music died. Fast forward back to 1963 now. Patsy Cline's response to Dottie West's offer of a ride in the car, quote, "Don't worry about me, Hoss. When it's my time to go, it's my time," end quote. It's one of those flippant remarks that people always say when they talk about death, thinking that their time isn't going to be anytime soon, and that they'll feel pretty content if they are blessed to know that their time is near and they have time to prepare. I'm not sure if Dottie was haunted by that remark for the rest of her life, but I sure would have been. It's also why I never say that actual phrase, because I know that no matter when my time comes, I will always have one more idea that I want to try. It's just how my creative mind works. All right, this isn't about me. Back to Patsy. Patsy stayed another night at the motel, called her mom around noon on March 5th, and then checked out of the hotel and went to the airport. She got into a Piper PA-24 Comanche airplane piloted by Randy Hughes. Also on the plane were Cowboy Copas and Hawkshaw Hawkins. Billy Walker was actually supposed to be on that plane. However, he had to take a commercial jet flight back home because someone in his family had gotten sick. So Hawkins actually took his place. Yet another eerie nod to the whole Buddy Holly crash. The plane left, made a stop in Rogers, Arkansas to refuel, and then flew to Dyersburg, Tennessee and landed around 5 p.m. The weather had gotten pretty bad, so the airport manager offered the passengers and the pilot free rooms for the night and told them that they should fly out in the morning. The weather was cold and very windy, with cloud cover being low at around 500 feet. Not exactly prime weather conditions for flying in a rather hilly area. The pilot, Randy Hughes, said, quote, "I've already come this far. We'll be there before you know it," end quote, as they were only a couple of hours out of Nashville at that point. Hughes, by the way, did not know how to do any instrument flying in bad weather, in yet another eerie nod to the Buddy Holly crash, as their pilot was not familiar with how to fly in bad weather. In fact, Hughes had told the manager that he was familiar with the terrain and would fly back to the airport if he felt that he couldn't make it. The plane, with everybody on board, left for Nashville, Tennessee at 6:07 p.m. in bad weather. When the plane didn't land in Nashville, people became worried. People called around and started searching for the plane. Among the people who searched was soon-to-be country music legend himself, Roger Miller. And it was he and his group of searchers who found the wreckage of the plane in Camden, Tennessee, about 90 miles outside of Nashville. All on board were killed instantly. When they found Patsy's watch, it said 6:20 p.m., which was probably the moment of impact, although some reports have the crash happening at 6:29 p.m. That wristwatch, along with a few other items from the crash site, were donated to the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum in Nashville. Some were also donated to the Patsy Cline Museum, which isn't too far from the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum in Nashville. Patsy was buried in her hometown of Winchester, Virginia. Patsy's voice and style still to this day inspire many singers, including Reba McEntire and Leanne Rimes. She was also a pioneer for women trying to make it into country music in the early 1960s. She's on Rolling Stone's list of 100 Greatest Singers and is a member of the Country Music Hall of Fame. She's also been the subject of movies. Her famous friendship with country music legend Loretta Lynn has been portrayed in the Loretta Lynn biopic Coal Miner's Daughter, where she was played by Beverly D'Angelo. Jessica Lange played Cline in Cline's 1985 biopic Sweet Dreams, for which Lange received a Best Actress nomination at the Academy Awards. Cline's various friendships with other famous people, including Dottie West, have been portrayed in other movies, TV shows, theater productions, and documentaries. Patsy remains one of country music's most beloved performers. The tragic, untimely death of country music icon Patsy Cline, along with Cowboy Copas and Hackshaw Hawkins in a plane crash on March 5th, 1963. This next artist's story is an all-too-familiar one about immense talent that was squandered by demons of one sort or another. Those of you of a certain age no doubt have heard of the Brothers Gibb, a.k.a. Barry, Robin, and Maurice Gibb, better known as the Bee Gees. Their history you probably know, and their songs you absolutely know. They were listed as one of the greatest groups of all time. Their soundtrack to Saturday Night Fever is still one of the best-selling albums of all time and helped to usher in the disco era into mainstream America after being the domain of blacks, Latinos, and gay people for almost a decade. Plus, they were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But what you may not remember is that for a brief few years, there was another member of the Gibb family who had a career that rivaled even the Bee Gees' popularity. Andy Gibb was born on March 5, 1958. From the time he was 10 years old, he was in his famous older brother's shadows. When he was a teenager, he decided that he wanted to get into the family business. He tried to get a band together in both England and Australia, with his brothers helping him out on songwriting and playing background instruments. Nothing really caught on until Robert Stigwood heard some of his demo tracks. Stigwood at the time was the owner of record label RSO and was also the manager of the Bee Gees. Stigwood listened to him, liked what he heard, and signed Gibb to a record deal. Andy got to work writing songs with his brothers helping out. He started out hot right out at the gate. His first three release singles each went to number one on the Billboard Singles Chart, making him the first male solo artist to accomplish that feat. I Just Want to Be Your Everything, Love Is Thicker Than Water, and Shadow Dancing made his albums into multi-platinum sellers and turned Gibb into an international superstar at the exact same time that his brothers were megastars. He parlayed that success into hosting gigs on the TV show Solid Gold and on Broadway in the musical Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. Now, while Gibb wanted all this fame and adoration, he forgot that fame comes at a cost. The first rule is, if you live by the trend, then you die by the trend. When Gibb broke out, disco was already well into its height of popularity and was beginning its downward spiral, although no one really knew it at the time. Also, Gibb had always lived in his brother's shadows. He figured that once he had a big career, that would change. It didn't. Some of his detractors kept pointing out that if it wasn't for his last name and his brothers helping to write his songs, he never would have gotten his recording contract in the very first place. The thing was that even though his brothers were co-writers on his songs, Andy did help write all of his own songs, and he was a really good songwriter in his own right. He would never get as much credit as he deserved and would forever be known as the Bee Gees' baby brother, which made him feel very insecure. And that insecurity helped lead to bouts of depression, and it would also lead to drug problems, very serious drug problems. Andy's drug of choice was the sexy drug of choice for rich people at that time, cocaine. His drug binges were such that he would go missing for days at a time. Eventually, drugs would cost him everything. Drugs cost Gibb his recording contract as RSO cut him once his contract ran out. Drugs cost him his hosting gig on Solid Gold and his role in Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, as he was usually missing from his shows. Drugs cost him his relationship with the hot sex symbol actress at that moment, Victoria Principal of the uber-popular TV show Dallas, as Gibb famously chose drugs when Victoria gave him an ultimatum of choosing between her and his drug habit. Gibb was in and out of rehab throughout most of the 1980s. In 1987, he went bankrupt with only $8,000 to his name. Finally, in 1988, Andy seemed to be doing well and was sober. He got work on getting a comeback of sorts going and started working on new songs, which brought him a whole lot of joy. On March 5th, 1988, Gibb celebrated his 30th birthday. On March 7th, only 2 days after his birthday, Gibb complained of chest and abdominal pains and was sent to the hospital. 3 days after that, on the morning of March 10th, the doctor in the hospital told him he would need more tests to determine how to proceed. He wouldn't get the chance to do those tests. Andy Gibb passed away later that day in the hospital from heart inflammation brought on by a viral infection. The cocaine abuse had taken its toll. Years of ravaging his body with cocaine made his heart muscles weak so that when a virus came along, his heart wasn't strong enough to protect itself. Between 1977 and 1980, Andy released three albums. His first two albums, 1977's Flowing Rivers and 1978's Shadow Dancing, both hit platinum, while his 1980 album, After Dark, went gold. He also had six songs that went to the top 10. I Just Want to Be Your Everything, Love Is Thicker Than Water, and Shadow Dancing all hit number one. Desire hit number four, and Everlasting Love hit number five, and Our Love, Don't Throw It All Away hit number nine. The sad part to all of this is that Andy had the talent to be an even bigger star. He could have easily have survived the decline of disco, except that drugs took over and crushed his career, and eventually, indirectly, led to his death at the age of 30. A flame that burned brightly for a short amount of time. The Life and Times of Andy Gibb, March 5th, 1958 to March 10th, 1988. Before we get to our final story, there is one honorable mention. On March 9th, 1997, an artist who was just beginning to make his presence known to the world was taken from this earth. Christopher Wallace, a.k.a. Big Papa, Biggie Smalls, the notorious B.I.G., was gunned down in a car in Los Angeles, California, bringing an unofficial end to the East Coast-West Coast feud that also cost the life of Tupac Shakur only a year earlier. And while Biggie was popular while he was alive, he became even bigger in death and is now considered either the greatest or second greatest rapper of all time, depending on which side of that whole East Coast-West Coast rivalry you sit on. Now then, in the early to middle part of the 20th century, there was a towering leader on the world stage. His name was Joseph Stalin. At one time, he edited the Russian newspaper Pravda and was one of the leaders of the Bolshevik Revolution that helped take down the czars of Russia. He helped to form the Soviet Union in 1922 under its first leader, Vladimir Lenin, who he had met at a conference in 1905. Lenin didn't trust Stalin too much and didn't actually want him succeeding him upon his death. But despite that, Stalin did by consolidating power. That consolidating, by the way, included imprisoning and killing people who he thought were, quote, enemies of the state, end quote. Where have I heard this before? Seems rather recent and in America. Anywho, those enemies included the press, military leaders, business leaders, intellectuals, political leaders, government institutions, etc. In short, he had hundreds of thousands of his own people killed in a five-year span known as the Great Purge. All this happened before World War II, when he first sided with the Nazis and then switched sides once Hitler and the Nazis invaded Russia. At that point, the Allied powers of the United States and England decided to overlook Stalin's little inhumane acts, you might say, taking a enemy of my enemy is my friend approach to Stalin, we'll say. With Russia squeezing in from the east and the US and England squeezing in from the west, Hitler was eventually defeated. What happened in the years after World War II was the start of the Cold War. Stalin and his brand of communism, known as Stalinism, ruled with an iron fist. Winston Churchill warned of what was happening in his famous Iron Curtain speech. The United States and Russia pushed their interests worldwide, with the Soviet Union now including countries that it took over after World War II. And Russia was now also armed with nuclear weapons, which raised the stakes tremendously. Stalin also effectively closed off communication with the West so that no one knew what was going on in Russia. You didn't even know if someone died. In fact, the only way to know what was going on was if you intercepted communications or had notes passed through spy networks. And it was through the interception of communications that the non-communist world found out on March 5th, 1953, that Joseph Stalin had died. Now, what in the world does all of that have to do with music? Well, here is where this little history lesson on Stalin and communism gets its musical connection. A man enlisted in the United States Air Force on July 7, 1950. He was eventually stationed in Landsberg, Germany, in the 12th Radio Squadron Mobile of the Air Force Security Service, to be precise. And it was one of the many places where the United States had operations set up to intercept messages from the Soviet Union. As a Morse code operator, this man's job was to intercept and decode the messages going through the Soviet Union, and he was extremely good at it. On March 5th, 1953, he intercepted a message given to Soviet Union Army officials. He helped to decode it, and that was how the United States, President Dwight D. Eisenhower, and the United States people found out that Joseph Stalin had passed away. This man was honorably discharged on July 3, 1954. He eventually moved to Memphis, Tennessee, where he sold appliances. He was originally going to become a radio announcer, but he had a love for playing music. He auditioned for Sam Phillips at Sun Records, where he started recording. He went on to have a legendary career. He is one of the biggest selling artists of all time. His crossover appeal is such that he has been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, the Gospel Hall of Fame, and the Country Music Hall of Fame. So, that music legend who was also the man who intercepted the Morse code message that Soviet dictator extraordinaire Joseph Stalin was dead? None other than the Man in Black. Country music legend and United States Air Force Staff Sergeant Johnny Cash, who helped to decode the message that Joseph Stalin had passed away on March 5th, 1953. And that is it for the Music History In-Depth podcast for March 5th through the 11th. Thanks for listening.